Chapter 8. On going into the mess at Bruges, I found among my letters a note from her, which was terrible in its brevity. She simply said, "Dear Carl, I am going away for some days, and as I shall be traveling, it is no good giving you an address. To our next meeting. Zo." How horribly vague. Not an indication of her destination, her object, or the length of her absence. I rushed round to the flat, but found the place shut. The porter told me as he had gone away with her maid. He couldn't say when she'd be back, if at all. I gave him 10 marks, and he said she might be away a fortnight. If I'd given him 20, he'd have said a week. He obviously didn't know. I feel I could do anything tonight. Any mad evil thing would appeal to me. There is an uproar coming from the guest room, where a large and rowdy party are entertaining the chorus of a traveling revue company. I saw them when they arrived, horribly common-looking women, with legs like mine tubes. Another day and still no news. She might have had the softness of heart to write to me. She knows my address. This evening a letter from the little mother, who asks whether I can find time to go to Frankfurt when I have leave. At the end of the letter she mentions that Rosa has joined the Women's Voluntary Auxiliary Corps of Army Nurses. I suppose she thought she'd like her photograph taken in some fancy uniform as Rosa Freinland, one of our Frankfurt beauties, now on war work. Holding the patient's hand is about the only work she intends doing. The British Empire is undeniably a great creation, or not so much a creation as a thing arrived at accidentally, but it lacks solidarity. It sprawls, a confused mass of races and creeds, around the world. Its immensity lays it open to attack. It has a dozen Achilles' heels from Ireland to Egypt, and South Africa to India. I met a man only yesterday who was recently at the propaganda department of the Foreign Office, and without going into details, he gave me a very good idea of the work going on in Britain's canker spots. Ireland is considered particularly promising to those in the know. Now for an agitated night. To think that a girl should disturb me so. 2 days have passed, or dragged their interminable lengths away, for there is still not a vestige of news. I have been twice to the flat with no result, except to receive a piece of impertinence from the porter. No news. Still no news, and we sail in 48 hours. At sea, off the Isle of Wight. It is some days since I turned to my pen and notebook. I have had news, but it was like a drop of water in the mouth of a parched-up man. Another agonizing 24 hours passed, and I was sitting in my room about 10 o'clock, trying to resign myself to the idea that the next night I should be starting out for my third trip without news of her, when the telephone bell rang. I lifted the receiver, and to my amazed joy, heard a voice that I could have recognized in a thousand. It was Zoe. Is that you, Carl? How are you? How was I? What a question to ask. I was quite incapable of answering her simple question. I can't imagine what I expected her to say. Well, you might ask how I am. My apologies were cut short by her laugh. I wasted no time in suggesting that I might go round and see her. I pleaded hard, and urged my departure in 24 hours. She was firm, and reproved me for discussing movements over the telephone. She said that I might lunch with her next day, and that S.E. had some new music to play to me. 10 minutes had not elapsed, when a messenger entered, and informed me that I was wanted at the Commodore's office. A feeling of uneasiness and impending misfortune overcame me. I followed the messenger into the Commodore's office, and found myself alone with the great man. He was seated at a roll-top desk, which was the only article of furniture in a room papered with large-scale charts of the east and south coasts of England, and of the Channel and North Sea. The Commodore was sealing an envelope as I came in. Admiralty. In about a minute he was connected. He was talking to the duty captain of the operations department in Berlin. Commodore speaking. U-39 sails at 2 a.m. for Operation FQH. Repeat, He banged the receiver into place and snapped at me. "You Lieutenant von Schenk. Kranz, 1st Lieutenant U-39, reported suddenly ill, Z-Brug, poisoning, you relieve him. Ship sails in 1 hour 40 minutes from now. My car leaves here in 40 minutes and takes you to Z-Brug. Here are operation orders. Inform von Weissman he acknowledges receipt direct to me on phone. That's all." I found myself in the corridor turning the envelope round and round. For one mad moment I felt like rushing in and saying, "But sir, you don't understand, I'm lunching with Zoe tomorrow." I had 35 minutes to collect such gear as I had handy, most of my sea things being in UC-47, and say goodbye to Zoe. I ran to my room and made the corridors echo with shouts for Adolf. The excellent man was soon on the scene, and while he stuffed under clothing, towels and other necessary gear into a bag, I rang up Zoe. I wasted 10 minutes getting through, but at last I heard a sleepy voice murmur, "Who's that?" I told her, and added that I was off. "Ooh-oh. So she does care a bit," I thought. The old man's car, which is a 60-horsepower Benz, was waiting at the mess entrance, and once clear of the sentries we raced down the flat, well-metalled road to Z-Brug. The guard at Bruges Barrier had phoned us through to the Z-Brug fortified zone, and we were admitted without delay. In 3/4 of an hour from my interview with old Max, I was scrambling across a row of U-boats to reach my new ship, U-39. I went down the after hatch, reported myself to von Weissman, and delivered his orders to him, of which he acknowledged receipt direct to the Commodore according to instructions. Von Weissman is a very different stamp of man to Alten. Medium height, he has sandy-colored hair, steel-gray eyes and a protruding jaw. He is what he looks, a North Prussian, and is, of course, of excellent family, as the Weissmans have been settled in dry nets for a long period. 30 years of age, on his heart he wore the cross of the second class. An interesting chart is hanging in the wardroom, on which is marked the last resting place of every ship he has sunk. He puts a color dot, the tint of which varies with the tonnage, black up to 2,000, blue from 2,000 to 5,000, brown 5,000 to 8,000, green 8,000 to 11,000, and a red spot with the ship's name for anything over 11,000. He has got about 120,000 tons at present. Weissman has done nearly all his work with the torpedo. The U-39 was in the buzzing and semi-active condition of a ship about to sail. Punctually at 5 minutes to 2 a.m., Weissman went to the bridge, and at 2 a.m. the wires were slipped. As the dim lights on the mole disappeared, and the fountain of star shells, mingling with the flashing guns, rose inland on our port beam. My mind traveled overland to the flat at Bruges, and I wondered whether Zoe was awake. We went on at full speed. It was our intention to pass the Dover Straits before dawn. I was surprised at the ease with which we passed. Von Weissman described to me his method, which has the merit of simplicity. He always goes through with the tide, so as to take as short a time as possible, and he always decides on a course, and steers it as closely as possible, keeping to the surface, unless he sights anything, and diving as soon as anything shows up. Even if he dives, he goes on as fast as possible on his course, irrespective of whether he is being bombed or not. I must say it worked very well last night. We shaped a course to pass 5 miles west of Christnes, and when that light, which for some reason the French had lit that night, was abeam, we sighted a black object, probably a trawler or destroyer, about half a dozen miles away. Weissman dived, and, without deviating a degree from his course, held on at 3/4 speed on the motors. Some time later, the hydrophone watchkeeper reported the sound of propellers in his listeners. He judged them to be close at hand. We passed directly underneath whatever it was. After an hour submerging, we rose to find dawn breaking over a leaden and choppy sea. We continued on the surface for an hour, charging batteries with the starboard engine, 500 amps on each. But at 9 a.m. we dived down channel at slow speed, keeping periscope depth. Several times in the course of the forenoon we sighted small destroyers and convoy craft in the distance, steering westerly. They were returning from escorting troop ships over to France. We went to 60 feet before they could have seen our stick. Weissman is as cautious in this as he is hardy in others. The more I see, the more I like him. He is a man of breeding. We are on the surface, 10 miles east of the Isle of Wight, steering down channel. Tonight at midnight we report our position to Zeebrugge. Till now we have maintained wireless silence for fear of the British and French directional stations picking up our signals and fixing our position. After supper this evening, von Weissman explained to me the general plan of our operations for the next 8 days. Our cruising billet is about 150 miles southwest of the Scillies, at the focal point, where trade for Liverpool and Bristol and the up-channel trade diverges. Von Weissman says that this is a plum billet, and we should do well. I feel this is going to be better than those mine-laying trips, and though we shall be away 10 days, it will qualify me for 4 days' leave in Belgium. There was an awkward moment, and nearly an awkward accident. I relieved the navigator at midnight. The pilot is an unassuming individual called Siegel, and took on the middle watch. It was blowing about force 4 from the southwest. A nasty short, lumpy sea was running which caught us just on the port bow. Every 10 seconds she missed her step with the waves, and, dipping her nose into it, shoveled up tons of water which, as the bow lifted, raced aft breaking against the gun, and flung itself in clouds of spray against the bridge. In a few minutes I was streaming with water. At about 2 a.m. I turned my back to the sea. My thoughts were in Bruges. On facing forward I was brought me back to earth. Two steamers, one on either bow, at 600 or 700 meters. I decided that to fire a torpedo in that sea with any hope of a hit, especially with the boat on surface, was useless. At any moment either of the steamers might sight us from their high bridge and turn and ram. I rang the diving bell, and pushing the lookout before me, in 5 seconds I was in the conning tower, and at the hatch down. I proceeded down into the boat. The diving gauge needle was stationary at 2 meters. The boat was not going down. A cool voice from the wardroom remarked, "Helm hard a port." As she began to turn, the needle on the depth gauge moved round the dial. It was the captain. As soon as he heard the diving alarm he was out of his bunk, and a glance at the gauge he has fitted in the wardroom told him we were not sinking rapidly. In an instant he had put his finger on the trouble. We were almost head on to the sea. Bringing us beam on to the sea had caused her to dive with ease. We had run into a convoy homeward bound to Southampton from the Atlantic. He approved of my actions in every particular, save only my omission to bring the boat away from the sea as I began to dive. This morning we are beginning to get the full force of a southwesterly gale. The seas are getting larger. This looks bad for business. We are hove to on the surface, with the port engine just jogging to keep her head on the sea, and the starboard ticking round to give her a long, slow charge of 200 amps. The wind is force 7 or 8, and a big sea is running, which makes it impossible to open the conning tower hatch. The engine is getting its air through the mushroom ventilator, which is not designed to supply both the boat's requirements and those of the engine. The whole ventilator gets covered with sea every now and then, until the baffle drains get the water away no air can get in. So the engine has a good suck at the air in the boat, the result being a slight vacuum in the boat. It is an unpleasant sensation, and made me sick. I looked at the barograph this morning. The needle had gone right off the paper at the bottom. I thought we had struck a tropical depression of the first magnitude. Flouting all the laws of meteorology, it had somehow found its way to the English Channel. But the engineer explained to me that the low atmospheric pressure in the boat was due to the conning tower hatch being shut. I have discovered that von Weissman is a martyr to seasickness. All day he has been as white as a sheet, subsisting on milk tablets and sips of brandy. Yet such is the man's inflexibility of will that he makes a tour of inspection every 6 hours, night and day. We are keeping watch from inside the conning tower. It is dry, but as to seeing anything, one might as well be looking through a small glass window from inside a breakwater. To bed till 4 a.m. This morning about noon the gale blew itself out, but a heavy confused sea continued to run. At 2 p.m. we saw a big tank steamer, 600 feet long and 17,000 tons, escorted by two destroyers. To attack with the gun was impossible, as we could only keep the conning tower open when stern to sea. In any case, the two destroyers prevented surface work. We tried to get in for an attack, but had not seen her in time. The best we could do was to get within 3,000 yards, at which range it would have been absurd to waste a torpedo, the chances being 100 to 1 against, even if the torpedo ran properly. The destroyers were having a bad time of it, crashing into the sea like porpoises, their funnels white with salt, and their bridges enveloped in sheets of water and spray. These damned British have pluck. It was the last sort of weather, to find destroyers at sea, and yet I suppose they do this throughout the winter. Let's hope we get some decent weather tomorrow. I have been present at my first sinking. It was absurdly commonplace. At 10 a.m. this morning a column of smoke crept upwards from the southern horizon. Von Weissman steered towards it on the surface, until two masts and the top of a funnel appeared. We dived on a southerly course. Half an hour passed, von Weissman brought the boat up to periscope depth, and had a look. He called me to come and see. I looked through the periscope and there she was, ambling to her doom like a fat sheep. She was a British steamer of 4,000 tons, slugging home at a steady 10 knots, but she was destined to come to her last mooring place ahead of time. We dipped our periscope and I went forward to the tubes. The order instrument bell rang, the pointer flicking to stand by. I removed the firing gear safety pin, and put the repeat to ready. A breathless pause, then a slight shake, and destruction was on its way, while I realized by the angle of the boat that Weissman was taking us down a few meters. He didn't even trouble to watch his shot. Weissman told me the range was 500 meters, 30 seconds, 31, 32, 33, has he missed? 34, 35, 36, a dull rumble comes through the water and the whole boat shakes. We have hit, and the order, surface, comes along the voice pipe. The voice of the blower is heard evacuating the tanks. I run to the conning tower and follow Weissman up the ladder. I am on the bridge. There she is. What a sight. I shall never forget what she looked like. She was my first. I felt the same sensation when I shot my first deer in the Black Forest. I am a sailor. To every sailor, every ship that floats has a soul, a personality, an entity. A merchant craft is like some fat beast of utility, an ox, a cow, or a sheep, while a warship is a lion, if she is a battleship, a leopard if she is a light cruiser, in all cases worthy game. The steamer had been hit forward on the starboard side. The upper portion of the stem piece was almost down to water level. Her foremost hold was filling rapidly. Her stern was high out of water, the red ensign of England flapping. Her propeller, still slowly revolving, thrashed the water, revolving in spasmodic jerks, due to the fast-failing steam only forcing the cranks over their dead centers with an effort. A boat was being lowered from the davits, abreast the funnel on one side. Someone inboard let go the foremost faller it broke, for the bows of the boat fell downwards and half a dozen figures were projected into the sea. For a few seconds the boat swung backwards and forwards, like a pendulum. When she came to rest, hanging vertically downwards from the stern, I noticed men clinging like flies to her thwarts. Anything is better than the Atlantic in winter. The ship had ceased to sink as far as outward signs went. I mentioned this to von Weissman. He answered me, I need not worry, she was being supported by an airlock somewhere forward, that the water was slowly creeping into her, and her boilers would probably go soon. There was an interval of about 5 minutes. Another boat, lowered from the other side, came round her stern, picked up one or two men from the water, and also collected the survivors in the hanging boat. Then the steamer sank another 2 feet. There was a dull rumbling, as of heavy machinery falling from a height, a muffled report, a cloud of steam and smoke, a sucking noise, and then a pool in the water, in the middle of which odd bits of wood, and other buoyant debris kept on bobbing up. Nothing else. I felt hushed and solemn. A slight chuckle came from Weissman. He gave an order for the helm to be put over, so we might approach the whaler. They were horribly overcrowded, and were engaged in trying to sort themselves into some sort of order. We passed by them at 50 yards, and Weissman, seizing his megaphone, shouted in English, "Goodbye! Steer west for America!" A cold horror gripped my heart. It was an awful moment. I faced aft, that he should not see my face. Looking back, I saw the whaler rocking dangerously in our wash, and then a commotion took place in her stern, from which a huge bearded man arose, and, shaking his fist in our direction, shouted something or other before his companions pulled him down. Von Weissman heard and his lips narrowed in. I held my breath in suspense, but he evidently decided against what he had been about to do, for with the order, "Course north, 10 knots, he went below. I remained on deck watching the whaler through my glasses until she was a speck, alone on the ocean, 150 miles from land. The navigator came up, and with feelings of joy and sorrow I went below. Von Weissman was in the wardroom. I watched him unobserved. He was humming a tune to himself, and had just completed putting a green dot on the chart. I could not forget that whaler. I see it as I write. What would Zoe say? Diary of a U-Boat Commander.